Good morning from the NBC newsroom in New York. This is the 520th day of war. Our staff of American reporters in Great Britain are first today with the late news in England. Go ahead, London.
This is London, Ed Doyce speaking. The daylight raids on London grew more vicious this morning. The third alert is now on, and a lone plane has just sent down a stick of heavy explosives which could be heard in the heart of town. There were casualties because few people allowed their daily work to be interrupted. In the murky weather, the lone raiders shot out of the clouds and disappeared in a flash. One apparently attempted to machine gun a barrage balloon. The AA gunfire is spasmodically heavy. Mr. Wilkie missed it because he is on a secret trip inspecting defenses. The morning papers publish copious extracts of Hitler's speech. The comments in all may be summed up as confident contemptuousness. The speech, says the Labour Party's Daily Herald, was a caricature of reality. Pure fantasy, but fantasy with a purpose. Whenever the Führer sounds most nearly mad, there is most method in his madness. It must be for his own war-weary folk that he is building this new myth of a quick peace. The Daily Herald maintains that Hitler made his eighth mistake of the war yesterday. He threatened America. He threatened sea attack. You may anger Americans, the paper says, but you can't scare them. Swiftly, Roosevelt gave Hitler evidence of that by releasing the text of his week-old message of friendship to Halifax. The Evening Standard today notes one new thing that Hitler said. We are all Jews now. Thor, Odin, Wotan, and all the other gods are shuffled off their pedestals. Hitler now appears in the full garb of a European revolutionary, the savior of a continent against the intrigues of Jewish potentates of Britain. It is subtle propaganda and not ineffective even here. The confidence of the British people is strikingly expressed in the fact that 24 hours after the thunderbolts hurled from Berlin, the discussion of peace aims and of the British social order after the war continued unabated. Jeffrey Mander, the Liberal Party firebrand in the House of Commons, tabled a six-point motion asking the government to declare that it is fighting to restore freedom to all peoples overrun by Nazi or fascist aggression, to supply food to all peoples immediately after an armistice and the evacuation of occupied territories, to set up a world organization against war, to build a new social order, and to refuse to negotiate with the present regimes in Germany and Italy. At the same time, Maurice Healy, the well-known Irish Catholic lawyer, says in an article that world events have progressed so far that the best, quote, we individualists can hope for is a limitation of state interference, unquote. The nationalization of railways, banks, and mines he foresees as unavoidable. A few have enjoyed, he declares, what was meant for everyone. And while I would compensate existing owners, I can see no spoliation in depriving them of what was never intended to be theirs. The government, of course, doesn't see things that way as yet. But it is surprising how many voices are being raised in the financial district in favor of a comprehensive financial and economic plan in order to prosecute the war more effectively. These voices will, no doubt, be fortified by the announcement that the government will shortly ask the House of Commons to vote another war credit of probably $4 billion, like the last credit 3 months ago. If the present rate of war spending of $36 million a day is maintained, the new credit would easily last out the fiscal year, which ends March 31st. The House will also be asked to vote a supplementary civil budget of about $1.5 million. The recovery of British exports in December of 12.5% over the wartime low level in November is regarded as cheering both from the foreign exchange point of view and the military point of view, since it indicates the extent to which the U-boat menace was circumvented in that month, though it was not one of intensive activity. The mass of the people, nevertheless, are still in the lead in demanding more sacrifices. They want to live, but above all, they want to work for the war effort. Another restriction was imposed today. Horses were put on ration cards in response to a chorus of protests that these nice animals were taking food out of the mouths of the people. Horses lucky enough to work for undertakings of national importance will not be rationed, but racing and riding horses cannot eat all the oats, bran, and beans they might want. Every animal now is rationed as to the quantity or quality of food. Hay and straw are not yet rationed. This is London returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
That's the report from London this morning. From the Associated Press, this dispatch dated Rome. The Italian High Command announced today that fascist forces had abandoned Derna and had withdrawn to the west and south to avoid being surrounded. The Daily War Bulletin also reported that German planes, which have been reported cooperating with the Italians in the Mediterranean, had bombed the Suez Canal yesterday. Next, our report from the Reich. Go ahead, Berlin.
Hello, NBC. This is Theodor Knaut speaking from Berlin. Yesterday was a busy day for interpreters in Berlin, for the Hitler speech, which lasted over an hour and a half, was immediately translated into 31 foreign languages and dialects and broadcast from here all over the world. It is being repeated today for the benefit of anybody who may have missed it yesterday. Listening to it myself on the radio at home and without all the trappings of the unannounced meeting at the Sportspalast, which was nevertheless filled to capacity, I found myself comparing it to the many other Hitler speeches that I have heard, and I was struck particularly by the increasing use he has been making of irony and sarcasm in his more recent efforts. An example is his challenge to the British to let him know in advance where they intend to land to begin an invasion of the continent, as he would in that case evacuate the country where they disembarked, and then they could speak to them in the only language that they understood, he said. The Beitzet am Mittag singles this out as a particularly effective bit. Hitler once more dissected British plans for social reform and scored the British capitalists and plutocrats, on whom he vented his scorn with his usual bitterness to the great applause of his audience. On looking back at the speech as a whole, I find that the passage that stood out the most was the one that the papers here headline as a warning to America, the part where he said, referring to Britain's position, quote, "What is it that they hope for? For help from elsewhere? From America? I can only say that we have allowed for every possible contingency in advance. That the German people has nothing against the people of America is clear to anyone who does not twist the truth on purpose. Germany has never represented interests in the American continent other than when Germans took part in fighting for its freedom. If any state on that continent should now attempt to take a hand in the European conflict, then the aims of the fighting would change still more rapidly. Europe would then defend itself. Let there be no doubt about it. Anyone who thinks he can help England must know that every ship, alone or accompanied, that shows itself in front of our torpedo tubes will be torpedoed." In official, end quote. In official circles, by the way, this is interpreted as meaning within the war zone area, which Germany has declared in the waters around England and far out into the Atlantic, and not anywhere else on the high seas. Outside the above passage, there was no reference in the speech, directly or indirectly, to the United States, and it is especially striking that there was no attempt made to reply to President Roosevelt. This reticence has been the subject of comment in diplomatic circles here, I understand. "England will be struck wherever she shows herself," Hitler also said, and this has been interpreted as a reference to a possible offensive in the Balkans, it being said that it was the other side that first spoke of the Balkans as a potential theater of war. There was, of course, no hint given of an attempt to invade England, but an increase in the submarine war was promised in the spring also of aerial attacks. There's no further word from Vichy, but the German ambassador Abetz has returned to Paris after having met with all the people here who are in touch with the situation there. The attacks in the Paris press on the Pétain government are being continued and are becoming sharper. Military news of the day, as reported in the German communique, is concerned mostly with an attack on London yesterday, in which planes were destroyed on the ground and a munitions dump was blown up. Factory buildings were destroyed east of Cambridge, in Stortford and Nottingham. A submarine sank 20,000 tons of enemy merchant ships, and planes 250 miles west of Donegal sank a small vessel and a smaller one off the mouth of the Humber. The British made no attempts to fly into Germany, but German chasers destroyed a dozen British balloons over Dover and London. This is Theodore Knaut speaking from Berlin and returning you to NBC.
Next, we take you to Earl Godwin for the late news on Capitol Hill, reported from the NBC newsroom in Washington.
Good morning, folks. In contrast to that interpretation of Mr. Hitler's speech, which you just heard from Berlin, you may have noticed that Hitler's threat to fire his torpedoes into any American aid that comes his way has not stopped the program here. The Lend-Lease bill, curried and combed and ready for a week on the track in the House of Representatives, was reported out favorably by 17 out of the 25 members of the Foreign Affairs Committee. Three Republicans voted with the Democrats. One Democrat voted with the minority. The general attitude of the solidly organized Democratic majority in the House is that this superlative overall legal authority to get, make, and give all possible American aid to beleaguered Democratic countries without bothering about the pay is the best way to keep out of the war. Well, on the other side of the House, the Republicans have not yet crystallized into any party or partisan policy, although the opposition to the bill will be led by Republican member Hamilton Fish of New York. My own rather hasty cloakroom view is that not one Republican out of five has made up his mind whether or not to support or oppose the bill in the final vote. One reason for this inconclusive state of mind is that most Republicans favor aid to Britain, but they're not quite sure on the manner of giving the aid. For instance, give Britain a credit out and out of $2 billion and let her continue buying and taking it away as at present. That's the view of one particular leader I talked to yesterday. Many Republicans do not like the grant of vast power to the president, in spite of the administration's argument that the bill does not grant powers not already granted by the Constitution or by existing law. The president, for instance, they argue, does not need any more law to send the United States Navy wherever he pleases around the world, as Theodore Roosevelt did. At any rate, on this subject, the House Republicans intend to confer this afternoon, the meeting having been called by their leader, Joe Martin, Representative Martin of Massachusetts, who, incidentally, has announced that he will resign as chairman of the Republican National Committee. You know, this government's highest officials have been very determined in their antipathy toward the so-called Aluminum Trust, despite the statement of aluminum officials that there is no conspiracy to keep production down and prices up. There is a growing feeling in administration circles here that someday something big will break over the heads of the aluminum producers. Well, now comes the charge that the so-called Aluminum Trust has worked up a deal with the German Dye Trust to control and keep down the production of the metal known as magnesium. That's something about a third lighter than aluminum and is essential in the manufacture of airplanes and bombs. The effect of this control, it is alleged here by officials, is to slow down the production of airplanes, and so an indictment against six companies and nine officials is lodged before a federal grand jury in New York and announced here. Meantime, in other quarters, Washington hears the charge that labor troubles are stopping defense production. Donald M. Nelson, an official of the Defense Commission, warns industry to cooperate willingly or else. And while Donald is thus threatening government action by priorities, Representative Leland Ford of California charges on the floor of the House that certain elements in organized labor have deliberately slowed up defense production. Ford charged that Sidney Hillman, CIO official, equal in production rank with Mr. Knudsen, is chiefly interested in CIO and is utilizing his post to wage war on the rival American Federation of Labor. Earl Godwin says goodbye. That's the news from Washington at this time.
Earl Godwin, who has just been heard from Washington, and our staff of American radio reporters abroad bring you the news each weekday morning at this same hour. Listen to our regular news broadcasts and keep abreast of history in the making. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
It's time to listen to the NBC Newsroom of the Air.
Good evening, everyone. This is John W. Vandercook in New York. Tonight, the newsroom takes you first direct to England. Will you go ahead, London?
This is John McVane in London. London has had no air raid alarm tonight, and no raiders are reported over Britain. But during daylight, three alarms were sounded. German planes, flying singly, attacked the capital from different directions. They ran over first, hiding in the heavy cloud formations that blanketed the entire area. It's officially stated that two of the German planes were shot down. The raiders were the light, fast fighter bombers that can carry light bombs and depend on speed and cloud cover to escape defending fighters. Some of the raiders stayed up in the clouds to drop their bombs, but others sounded as though they were diving down below the clouds occasionally to get a quick look at the ground. High explosives and fire bombs were dropped here and there, and the attacks were widespread. To most observers here, this type of raid seems to be a rather senseless one. The bombs are light and seem to be scattered by pilots who are in such a hurry to get rid of their load before they run into British fighters that they don't take the time to pick out an objective and plaster it with three or four well-aimed shots. In one residential section of London, we heard a bomber getting rid of a stick of four bombs. The first was a fair distance away. The second was closer, and by that time we were flat on the floor waiting for the third. You could tell they were light bombs with the whistle and the explosion. The third and fourth were fairly close. Then we heard the sound of the plane's engine growing fainter, and we knew then it was all right. Just outside, some workmen were putting up a new building. When I got to the window, the foreman was yelling at some of his men, working at a cement mixer. He was half angry and half laughing. He was saying, "With that machine making so much noise, you'll never hear them coming down till one drops inside." The front of his suit was dusty, as though he too had been lying on his stomach. Later, I went out to see where the bombs had fallen. One struck the sidewalk at the corner of a narrow alley. A mews, they call it here. The bomb had made a hole only a few inches deep and 4 or 5 feet across on the hard pavement. It had blown in the windows of several houses, and people said one person had been killed. Another bomb had knocked part of the roof off an empty house. I was told a fourth bomb had hit a small neighborhood shopping street and killed and wounded two or three people. That's about all that raids like today's do. Kill a few people and wound a few people. As far as one can see, they have precisely no effect on wrecking the British war effort or the morale of the Londoners. Because people nowadays don't pay an awful lot of attention to daytime raiders until something falls right next to them. Mr. Wendell Wilkie inspected defenses on the southeast coast today. Afterward, he said he thought the Germans would have a tough job if they try an invasion around where I've been. He saw anti-aircraft guns at Dover fill the sky with bursting shells when a German raider approached. And he also saw some of the big coast defense guns fired. Mr. Wilkie has been getting all the headlines in the British press, but Mr. Harry Hopkins, in a quiet way, has been carrying out a thorough investigation of affairs in this country. He is on noticeably friendly terms with Mr. Churchill, and today he accompanied the British Prime Minister on a tour of Southampton and Portsmouth. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
And now for the news direct from Italy. Go ahead, Rome.
Hello, NBC. This is David Anderson speaking from Rome. The recent Hitler speech has brought our attention around once more to the final drive which the Axis forces will attempt on the British Empire. But in retrospect, it is interesting to follow the development of Italian opinion, at least during the last few weeks, in view of coming events, which, according to Hitler, will culminate in a final Axis victory this year. When Italy entered the war, it was generally agreed that at least a portion of its fighting would be over in a few days or weeks at most. The Italian people at that time were riding the crest of a wave that suddenly broke, leaving the Italian people and armed forces face to face with a tougher enemy than anticipated. However, for a short time, it looked as though certain victory were in the bag for the Italians, and the reverses suffered in Greece were looked upon as only temporary setbacks, which would be compensated for by a final crushing blow at the Greeks. And yet this crushing blow was not so far materialized, and Mussolini was only too quick to sense that any hopes of a sudden victory were futile and to tell the Italian people that they must expect a long, hard struggle. They looked with envy on the wide expanses of the British Empire. They remembered Versailles, and any measures, including a long, hard war, seemed justified. For some time, the Italians felt confident of their own self-sufficiency. It was our soldiers, our navy, our air force who would bring glory to Italy. And yet, let's move the clock forward a little. After many weeks of hard fighting, the Italians are now in Albania and not in Greece, in Libya and not in Egypt. For a while, it looked as though the British were invincible. And then came word that German airmen were on their way down to Italy to assist the Italians in their fight for control of the Mediterranean. This temporarily changed the complexion of the war in this immediate vicinity, and now we heard more of Axis collaboration. Almost at once, Italian spirit took on new life, and the term Axis seemed to have teeth. The quick English drive in Abbardia, Tobruk, and Derna were interpreted here in Rome as mere political campaigns without much military significance. Following the recent Hitler-Mussolini meeting at Bacchus Garden, the statement issued by the Italians that the effects of this meeting will be felt shortly is looked upon with anticipation by the Italian people. More and more, the eyes of every Italian are turned toward Germany. Their hopes are pinned on Axis cooperation, but where those will come first is as yet unknown. So from the Italian point of view, I think there is only one thing which bears real watching, and that will be to see where Axis collaboration is next felt. If the big drive on the British Isles is successful, there is an outside chance that the Italian position will automatically be alleviated. There is also the possibility that the Axis may strike at other points of the empire before making any serious threats of invasion. Some neutral quarters in Rome are even of the opinion that an invasion will not be attempted at all. The answer to these questions is known perhaps only to two men, and it's a certainty they won't tell. This is David Anderson returning you to the National Broadcasting Company.
And now the newsroom here in Radio City in New York takes great pleasure in introducing a familiar voice and a familiar personality, Mr. Fred Bate, the chief of the National Broadcasting Company's London office, and the only American radio reporter who has the distinction of having been wounded in action by a Nazi bomb. Mr. Bate is now sitting here beside me, looking, I am glad to say, very well indeed. He has just come from Europe by clipper plane and has only been in this country for 5 hours. And now Mr. Bate is going to talk for a few minutes with the members of his staff back in London. As I have said many times before, will you go ahead, Fred Bate?
Thank you. It's the first time I've heard you say that at this short range. Hello, John.
Fred, how are you?
Well, I'm grand. How's Miss Boutwood?
Well, she's right here.
And Miss Peart?
Fine, thanks, Mr. Bates.
Well, that's good. Have you got that new office yet?
Yes.
Yes, all right. Installed.
Well, all right. You let us know where it is eventually.
Yeah.
Look here, will you tell, first of all, give my best to all of my friends there in the BBC.
Yes,
and
certainly.
Give my best to Ed Murrow of Columbia, will you? Tell him that I hope we'll be doing some more trips very soon now.
He left a message for you, Mr. Bates. He's just gone out. He said to give you his best if we heard from you.
All right, grand. We had a good trip on the Clipper. They expected it to be a rough one. It wasn't. We broke the record from Horta to Bermuda, in spite of heavy headwinds all the way. There's one thing that I want to talk to you about, John.
Yes, Fred?
I think either Miss Bartlett or Miss Peart will know how to get hold of him. I told the men in the NBC newsroom here about that young Frenchman, I think he was 18 or 19 or 20 years old,
yeah,
who built or reconstructed an old plane and,
yeah,
managed to flop it across the channel somewhere and land in England. That's all he wanted to do.
Yeah.
They'll remember about him if you don't.
Yeah, I remember.
Well, now they're interested, and will you try to get hold of him and invite him to do an interview with you?
Yes, I will, certainly.
If his English isn't...
Does he speak English, Fred?
Well, I think he speaks a little, but you can mix it with French.
Mm-hmm.
And interpret as you do the interview.
Yes.
There's one other thing. Tell all our friends there, will you, press and radio, that the one thing that's impressed me here in the few hours that I've been here is that everybody over here feels that both press and radio have kept the people of this country very well informed about what's going on in England.
Well, that certainly makes us feel fine, Fred, you know.
Well, you tell all our friends about that.
Yes, we will.
And the best to all of you.
Thanks very much, Fred.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank you, Mr. Bate. And now for a short news bulletin. Word has reached Vichy tonight that Thailand, with whom the fighting in Indochina has stopped for the moment under an armistice agreement, has now submitted its demands. They are heavy. As the price of a negotiated peace, the Siamese are insisting that the French give up almost as much territory as Siam might have expected to gain by an out-and-out victory. Thailand asks that France hand over to her practically the whole of the big southern province of Cambodia, nearly one-fourth of the whole large colony of Indochina. The Siamese government has also proposed another clause, which they want included in the treaty. If France ever gives up the sovereignty of all of Indochina to some other power, then Thailand wants a promise that she will have the first rights to still another big Indochinese province. That suggestion that someday France may be completely expelled from a richest Asiatic colony has, of course, an ominous sound. What is particularly troubling the Vichy government is that Siam's extravagant demands have been submitted to the French emissaries not by the Siamese themselves, but by the Japanese, who are supposed to be acting as entirely neutral arbitrators in the settlement of the dispute. And now we bring you Earl Godwin, reporting from the NBC newsroom in Washington.
Good evening, everybody. President Roosevelt, at the White House press conference this afternoon, which I attended, got into a very good-natured verbal exchange with Blair Moody of a Detroit News, and out of this exchange, the president said he'd been told that Senator Wheeler of Montana had declared that Nazi domination of Europe is inevitable and that as a matter of self-defense, this country would have to take over Canada, Mexico, and all of Central America. The president credited this tale to the late William E. Dodd, former ambassador to Germany. The president said that Dodd, in about 1934 or 35, while he was here in Washington, had informed him of these views after a dinner, which Dodd said was held at Rex Tugwell's house, where they were present, Dodd, Wheeler, and Senator Glass of Virginia. Well, Senator Wheeler is not in the city for comment. He's down south somewhere, but Senator Glass was reached at his house tonight, and he said he had never attended a dinner at Tugwell's and had never dined with Dodd. Well, then there's that other story, a recent story, which has attracted a good deal of attention and violent denial. That is the report that this government is considering a trade of destroyers. The number mentioned is 20 for the big British battleship George V, which brought Lord Halifax over here, landing him in the rain, you remember, at Annapolis with a great flare of publicity when the president went down to meet the new ambassador. The Navy said that this story of a trade of the battleship for destroyers is crazy. The president today told us at his press conference that it was a story invented by a Detroit paper. And yet, Clifford Prevost, the Detroit Free Press correspondent who wrote the original yarn, sticks to his guns. He says the story is right. Well, the brickbats began flying this morning on Capitol Hill when Saul Bloom, chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the House, appeared before the Rules Committee of the House to get the right of way for the lend-lease measure next week. Bloom was sailing along smoothly, but he was stopped by a roar from Representative Gene Cox of Georgia, Democrat, and a member of the Rules Committee, when Bloom referred to his bill as a defense bill. "It's a war measure," shouted Mr. Cox, "and I will support it as such." Well, they got into further argument about it. You know, there's a time limit on this bill, which expires, according to the bill's present arrangement, June 30th, 1943. That's 2.5 years hence. But Mr. Bloom disclosed what has been spoken of previously, that the time limit on the bill would not affect some of the contracts made under the bill. They might live for years or they might live forever. Mr. Bloom disclosed also that this time limit would not stop the president from making contracts whose life might extend beyond that date. "They will bind this government until doomsday," shouted Mr. Cox. "And it's a castor oil bill," Republican Representative Michigan shouted. "It is all doctored up to taste sweet to the people." A bill appropriating almost $1.5 billion to run the government's independent agencies in 1942 has been passed in 2 days by the House, and efforts to slash the bill have been defeated. There is absolutely no economy about the bill in any way, shape, or form. Earl Godwin says goodbye. I return you now to the newsroom of the air in New York City.
The announcement has been made in Athens tonight that the Greek armies in Albania have again begun a general advance along the middle northern front. A second big Italian counterattack has been thrown back, and the fascists, Athens says, have again suffered heavy losses. And that's all for tonight. This is John W. Vanderkirk saying good night.
Tonight, the NBC Newsroom of the Air has brought you the late news in London, Rome, New York, and Washington, and a two-way conversation between Fred Bate, chief of NBC staff in England, who arrived in New York today by Clipper, and his staff in London. This is the National Broadcasting Company.